And so the lesson of the case is that you are not entitled to use deadly force solely for the protection of property. Let's go on to the next case, which is Hodgdon versus Hubbard on page 120. You will note the date of the case, 1846. And I ask students in the class, when we're told that this was a dispute over a stove, what kind of a stove do you think it was? And how do you think Mr. Hodgdon got away with the stove? The answer, of course, is it was probably a kitchen stove, an iron kitchen stove, or an iron parlor stove, and it was undoubtedly taken away in a horse and cart, or maybe a horse and sleigh if it was the winter. And the defendants here, who sold the stove under a misapprehension as to the plaintiff's credit, discovered that once the stove had been taken away. And doubtless they got on their horses, that is to say the defendants, got on their horses, which would have been faster than the horse with the cart or the horse with the sleigh, and overtook the plaintiff and retrieved the stove with an accompanying breach of the peace. And the case was argued on the theory that the once the sellers had given up possession, they had no right to recover, even if the stove had been taken under a misapprehension as to the buyer's credit. You might say, to put it in modern terms, that the buyer used a credit card, got away with the stove before the sellers found out that the credit card was stolen or overdrawn or otherwise unavailable to pay for the stove. But the argument was the sellers could only retake the property by legal process. And I pause here to explain what legal process is available. It's called an action of replevin, R-E-P-L-E-V-I-N. That's an action to recover not damages for the taking of property, but rather to recover the property itself. It's an action well known in previous times and still very much available today when somebody has got property which you claim is your own and you want to regain possession of it without resorting to self-help. The necessity for the breach of the peace may have arisen because Mr. Hodgdon apparently produced a knife in defense of his possession of the stove, not his ownership, but his possession, and it was necessary to subdue him by force, and the court holds that that force was justified. The notes after the case tell you that the case law generally holds that only a hot pursuit recovery of property, only in a hot pursuit recovery of property is force justified. If Mr. Hodgdon had gotten the stove home and installed it in his kitchen, then certainly the privilege of recovering property taken wrongfully taken from its owner would have ceased. And Mr. Hubbard and his fellow seller would have been obliged to seek recovery by an action of replevin. And in any case, the amount of force used is limited to the amount that is reasonable under the circumstances. Going on to the next case, Bonkowski versus Arlen's Department Store. This is an illustration of something called the shopkeeper's privilege, which was recognized at common law and is now codified in a number of states, including Massachusetts. One thing I ask the students to think about as we approach this case is the entire subject of shoplifting and the question, what do the shoplifters really want? What do the shoplifters really want? What do shoplifters want the most? And everybody answered, oh, stolen goods. No, I say, stolen goods are the short money. The big money in shoplifting is to get arrested without having shoplifted, because the big money is in false arrest. And for the defense of the merchant, a number of states, as I said before, have codified the so-called shopkeeper's privilege, which is the privilege to detain a person reasonably suspected of shoplifting for a reasonable amount of time so as to make an investigation or to call on the authorities, the police, to come and resolve the situation. One question that arises is whether the shopkeeper's privilege extends to a situation where the shopper and suspected shoplifter has left the premises. At this point, I stop and I ask students who have some experience in retail what their retail employer's policy was on suspected shoplifters. And to a surprising extent, I find the answer is, once they're out the door, you do not go after them or pursue them. Only if the person believed to be a shoplifter passes the cash registers, and before that person leaves the store, do you have permission from the retail employer to intercept them and exercise the shopkeeper's privilege. Mrs. Bonkowski was outside the store, and the private policeman stopped her and asked her to show him the contents of her purse. She did. Without result, no shoplifted goods were found. And question was this conduct by the police officer on behalf of the department store justified by the shopkeeper's privilege? The second restatement took no position, understood, the second restatement recognized the privilege but took no position on the question whether it extends to suspected shoplifters who have left the premises. And the Court of Appeals of Michigan says, yes, the Court of Appeals, will recognize that the privilege extends to a distance beyond the doors of the store to an extent that need not be specified in this opinion but might well come up in another one. And it's the privilege to detain, which would otherwise be a false arrest, an individual for the purposes of making an investigation, because otherwise the shoplifter will go free and the merchant will have no redress. Okay, going on, that's the defenses of privilege to use force in defense of property. Going on to more defenses to intentional torts, the defense called necessity. And we go on to Sirocco versus Geary on page 126, where the plaintiff's house was set on fire for the purpose of containing a conflagration. Again, you need to locate this this case in time, in 1853. That's before the invention and development of the internal combustion engine-powered pump. When a fire in an urban neighborhood presented a terrible hazard of spreading from house to house until an entire community might burn down. And one of the standard ways of fighting a fire in those days, when you passed buckets from hand to hand, was to dynamite a firebreak, in other words, destroy property, built-up property, housing or other built-up property, in the face of the fire, in the hopes that the fire would not jump over the fire break. And that is what has been done in Sirocco versus Geary. The order was given by the alcalde. I always ask students, what does the alcalde mean? Just means the mayor. And the fire break was created by the dynamiting of the plaintiff's house. And while the plaintiff is undoubtedly left unhappy by that, he has framed his complaint in terms of not being given enough time to rescue the valuable furniture that was in the house, which is, of course, contrary to the emergency nature of what was going on. A couple of observations here. The spread of fire from house to house is still a problem. I remember a fire in the Dorchester District of Boston, where subsequent to my graduation from law school, sometime I think in the 1970s, where a rapidly spreading fire wiped out an entire block of three-deckers, and that was against all the resources that a big city fire department could bring up against the fire. It still happens. I don't believe that the device of dynamiting property to create a fire break was employed in that fire. I do understand that it was employed a few years ago in Oakland, California, when one of those bad California fires was threatening to sweep over a hill and demolish and just keep on burning house after house. Some houses were dynamited to create a fire break. That is an example of a public necessity. There are others. For example, the United States Department of Agriculture regularly destroys herds of animals, among whom there is animal disease, and without compensating the farmer. Why is that justified? Well, it's to prevent the spread of animal disease to other herds of animals, and also with recognition of the fact that the farmer whose animals are diseased isn't going to be able to bring them to market anyhow. The market is closed to meat from diseased animals, and so in that sense, the herd is not worth anything anyhow. Farmers can buy insurance against that catastrophe, but the insurance is expensive, and very few farmers do. And the ultimate public necessity, of course, is war. We have not fought a war on American soil since 1865, and people have forgotten about the fact that where the battle is fought, property will be destroyed, and there is not compensation for the destruction of property as a result of acts of war. The most recent example of that is Note 3 after the case where the United States Army destroyed POL stocks in tank farms in Manila in the Philippines upon evacuating the city. The owners of the fuel and oil and lubricants, gasoline that were in the tank farms, sued the United States to recover for the loss of that property, and the United States Supreme Court said, no, it's a casualty of an act of war, and it is not compensable. So if General Sherman chooses your farm on which to have his battle, that is just your tough luck. Going on to Vincent versus Lake Erie Transit Company on page 129. We said that Sirocco versus Geary illustrates the concept of a public necessity. Vincent versus Lake Erie Transportation Company illustrates the concept of a private necessity. Now, in Vincent versus Lake Erie Transportation Company, the ship that was tied up to a pier is not initially at all a trespasser. It's tied up at the invitation of the dock owner, the pier owner, for the purpose of unloading. But when the storm broke, the ship banged against the pier and inflicted damage upon it. All without fault, of course, on the part of the ship owner, who didn't cause the storm to come up, but took action to protect his vessel, or the captain, the master of the vessel, took action to protect it, but did so at the expense of the dock owner because of the ship banging and then striking the dock. And the master did take steps to keep the ship tied up. It says where a line broke, they would substitute a bigger and stronger line. So it was clear that the ship owner, ship master, was seeking to preserve his ship, but he did so at the expense of the dock owner. Held in those circumstances, the dock owner was entitled to be compensated. Where the plaintiff was initially a trespasser, the case is illustrated by Plouffe versus Putnam, which is mentioned on page 130, a very well-known Vermont case where a family out on a houseboat in the middle of Lake Champlain took refuge from a storm by tying up their houseboat to a waterfront property owner's dock. And the waterfront property had a watchman who came down and cut the lines holding the boat to the dock and causing the dock to drift off with subsequent damage and injury, according to the plaintiffs. That plaintiff was undoubtedly a trespasser, but that plaintiff was undoubtedly present on the at the property owner's dock against the property owner's will. But because of the necessity of taking refuge from the storm, that trespass, what would otherwise be a trespass, was deemed to be privileged as a matter of private necessity. And if the trespass is privileged, the landowner is not warranted in evicting or ejecting the trespasser, using no more force than is necessary, which is a rule that we've discussed several times in connection with the ordinary trespass. Therefore, the property owner, by his agent or his watchman, whoever it was, had overstepped his authority to evict trespassers and was found to be in the posture of the case, it was held to state a case for liability. It remained, of course, to the plaintiffs to prove the case. Finally, in this discussion of defenses to intentional torts, we come to Sindel versus the New York City Transit Authority. This is another case where I think the casebook editors have left out too much. If you read the case in its unedited form, you find that the kid who was imprisoned in the bus, the driver of which would not stop, the kid sought to free himself by climbing out a window, fell as he was climbing out the window, and was run over by the rear wheels of the bus, sustaining serious injury. The family sued for the injuries, and the question is, was the bus driver justified in what would otherwise be a false imprisonment of the students that he would not let off the bus, and he said until he got to the police station? The answer is that the defense called justification can be presented, creating a jury issue of whether the what would otherwise be an intentional tort is justified, and the jury is given a lot of discretion to decide what is a sufficient justification. A number of cases have occurred in which public protesters were arrested, have sued for false arrest, and in return the arresting sued for trespass, and in the course of a civil action for trespass, the defendants, protesters, have argued that their intentional tort, typically trespass, in connection with a public protest, is justified by the necessities of whatever was they were protesting. This defense was widely invoked in connection with the Vietnam War protests, mostly unsuccessfully, but it still enables a plaintiff to make a plea to the jury that the jury is entitled, under which the jury would be entitled to find, if it chose to do so, that the privilege of justification was a sufficient defense to what would otherwise be an intentional tort. Now, we're going to go on Monday to start the subject of negligence, and the assignment will be pages 139 through 151. We're now finished with intentional torts. I invite you to start thinking about an outline. I'll have more to say about that in my class today, Friday, in the afternoon. Have a good weekend, and we'll see you on Monday.